Well, we have a quorum, so let's get underway, please. My name is Tom Swain, and I've agreed to convene this session, period. Before we elect the chair, let's go around the table and introduce ourselves. Again, I'm Tom Swain. I'm a Supreme Court appointee to this council. And how many times have I been on? It's getting kind of quite a few, almost since its inception. We go to the left, please. Representative Atkins.
I am Joe Atkins. I'm state representative representing Invergrove Heights, South St. Paul, and Sunfish Lake in the Minnesota Legislature, and I am the House appointee, or one of the House appointees, to the Compensation Council.
I am Stan Durda, appointed through the governor's office. I suppose for me it's better to understand a little of the background, occupation. I love to say it. None. Retired about 5 years ago. Corporate experience ranges everything from sales and marketing through human resources, hence the connection to this group with 15 years of compensation experience, global basis, large corporation.
Your congressional district, what, please?
Nine.
That would be challenging.
Two. Yeah, two.
Okay. Nine was a better answer.
Nine was a better answer.
I'm John Stabler of the 7th District, Tom, Minnesota, so it's 200 miles northwest of here, and I'm a
gubernatorial appointee.
Excuse me?
A gubernatorial appointee.
Gubernatorial appointee, that's correct. That's correct. Small independent businessman.
He's Al.
He's Al Jones, a gubernatorial appointee, 5th District, background, risk management, insurance, sales and marketing, and just a citizen Jones today.
Ryan Earhart, state representative from the city of Edina, and appointed by the minority leader in the House.
Senator?
As usual, I'm on Senate time.
Are you? You're close.
Can I just sit anywhere?
Please.
All right.
And we're just going around the horn introducing ourselves. Tom Swain, nice to see you.
Long time no see.
Yes, it's been a bit.
Am I the last one?
No, but you're up.
All right. Well, I'm Mee Moore. I'm a state senator, and I was sent here by the majority leader. I represent Senate District 67, which is the east side of St. Paul.
Thank you. Sandy?
Sandy King, Legislative Coordinating Commission staff.
My name is Craig Shaver, and I'm from Deep Haven, and I'm a gubernatorial appointee.
John Stanek, I'm an appointee of the Supreme Court. I've also served on the Compensation Council several times, both as a Supreme Court and a gubernatorial appointee.
I'm Paula Leidekeimer, Congressional District appointee from Stillwater, 6th District.
I'm Kathy Meyerly from Rochester, the governor's first congressional district appointee.
I'm Greg Kupinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission, one of the staff that supports the council.
Extraordinarily well. Thank you. Next order of business, the election of chair. And I would entertain nominations for chair. Mr. Stanek, please.
Mr. Convener, although I think that our convener is an excellent and has been an excellent chair, upon discussion with you, sir, it's my understanding that you think maybe the Supreme Court's had a long enough run with the gavel here, and maybe it would be a good time to turn it over to gubernatorial appointee, and therefore I would nominate my good friend Mr. Shaver as chair of our August commission.
Thank you. Any further nominations?
I have a question, Mr. Chairman.
Please.
We all announced who we were appointed by. Are we representing those people, or are we just appointed by them? I mean, is Mr. Shaver going to carry through whatever the governor wants here, and are you going to carry forth whatever the Supreme Court wants, and so forth?
My understanding of my role in the past is that I'm here as a Supreme Court appointee, but I'm to look out for the interests of the entire population of this state and do what this council is charged with doing, is studying the compensation environment for the sectors that we're charged with looking at and recommending appropriate salaries for whatever disposition the legislature might ultimately decide to handle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Are there further nominations? Not. Nominations are closed. All those in support of Mr. Shaver's nomination for the post of chair. Please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Anyone to the contrary? Mr. Shaver, here it. Come on up, please.
Well, we don't have to move around.
Well.
Thank you for this opportunity, and I appreciate it.
Why don't you come up, please?
Okay.
Yes.
There you go. See, I asked him to be the chair the last time. I just took instruction then. I'll take instruction now.
Okay.
Thanks very much. I look forward to this, and I look forward to a free and frank exchange of views. It'll be interesting. This is my fourth time doing this. Once as a legislative representative, and this is my third round as a gubernatorial representative. And it's important stuff, and it's sensitive stuff. So the pay grade is low. And I appreciate your being here as a citizen. With that, Sandy, will you tell us a little bit about the administrative aspect of it?
Sure, Mr. Chair. All of you received, or except for members, legislative members, the rest of you received reimbursement forms in your packets. You should have also received the memo from me that was emailed to you, and it's also in the packets. I'm just going to go over it briefly with you. There's a sheet in your packet that describes how to fill out your reimbursement forms. I think most of you have been through this before. The important things to remember are filling it in properly so that accounting staff can get this reimbursed to you as quickly as possible. Make sure you fill out the date and the meeting location. Your mileage, if you don't know it, they'll calculate that for you. Just put where you're driving from and to. You must circle per diem, yes or no. If you are a state employee, you do not qualify for per diem. So there's a box down below that you need to complete if you're a state employee. Other than that, if you have any questions, I'll be here after the meeting to help you fill out the forms. If you haven't already provided your Social Security number to our accounting staff, you can leave it with me at the end of the meeting, or the phone number is on this memo that I sent to you if you'd prefer calling them directly to give it. If you have any questions, I will be here after the meeting.
Are there any questions of Sandy before we get going? If not, thank you. We're on to item four. Mr. Bodden, you want to talk a little bit about our charge?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Tom Bodden with the Office of Senate Counsel and Research. Among other things, I'm the counsel for the State Government Budget Division, which handles the budget for the legislative branch and the constitutional officers. I'll just highlight a few of the things that are in my memo that you should be able to find in your packet dated March 14th, headed Statutory Duties of the Compensation Council. The first and most important thing the Compensation Council has to do, not surprisingly given its name, is make salary recommendations to the legislature for constitutional officers, members of the legislature, and judges. And there is an additional duty to recommend salary ranges for the heads of state and metropolitan agencies. The only metropolitan agencies that are affected by those recommendations are the Met Council and the Metropolitan Airports Commission. And by the way, just about everything in this memo is a requirement that you'll find in law in Minnesota Statute Section 15A.082 that sets out the duties for the council. Recommendations are due by May 1st in each odd-numbered year. This year, for practical reasons, there may be a more compressed time frame given the budget timetables and the respective bodies of the legislature. The second item in the memo is discusses how and when the council's recommendations take effect. And the key element there is that they don't take effect. They would not take effect until January 1st of the next odd-numbered year. So in this instance, that would be 2009, and that's, of course, if money to implement the recommendations has been appropriated by them. And then the council can also recommend a single increase to take effect on January 1st of the subsequent year, which would be 2010 for this council. And obviously the legislature can do whatever it would like with the recommendations. In addition, and this is a topic, I guess, that's somewhat timely this year, the salary recommendations don't affect legislative changes in mileage reimbursement or per diem or additional compensation members who are in leadership positions. Then another item is the considerations the council has to look at in making its recommendations. You'll find that on page 2 of the memorandum. There are basically three items that the council is instructed to consider. First, the amount of compensation paid in government service and the private sector to persons with similar qualifications, and these apply to each of the both the constitutional officers, the legislators, and the judges. Second, the amount needed to attract and retain experienced and competent persons. And third, the ability of the state to pay those recommended levels. And then there's another nuance in making recommendations for legislators. There are a variety of considerations that are included in the statutory guidelines there, including the average length of sessions, the amount of work required, and perhaps most significantly, the members' opportunities to earn income from other sources without neglecting their legislative duties. The fourth item in the memo gives you a brief synopsis of why the council's recommendations for legislators, constitutional officers, and judges don't take effect for 2 years until after they're submitted. And, of course, that's driven by Article 4, Section 9 of the Minnesota Constitution, which provides that any increase can't take effect until the next biennium after the election of a new House of Representatives. So, again, reiterating, in this instance, that would mean that a legislative pay increase couldn't take effect until the 2009-2010 biennial session, if it were to be enacted this session. Although there's no similar constitutional restriction on enacting pay increases for constitutional officers and judges, the law for the Compensation Council basically says they're on the same time frame for the purpose of those recommendations. Then there are the final four items in the memo, items 5, 6, 7, and 8, basically talk about what happens once the council has finished its work. And under the statute, the council ceases to exist once the recommendations have been submitted. And again, there's a May 1st deadline for that. Item 6, the council can make other recommendations. They don't have any official standing, but there is, I suppose, some precedent for including some commentary that way. And if the recommendations are submitted after May 1st, they wouldn't have any official standing. There may be other practical considerations given the legislative timetable, but, of course, the legislature could consider them. And finally, if the council submitted its salary recommendations before May 1st, could it continue to meet after that date? It would, but since it would cease to have exist, or it could, rather, but since it wouldn't exist anymore as an official body, those any action taken after that point would be wouldn't have official standing, and the per diem payments, et cetera, support services wouldn't be required by statute. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
Okay.
And I think I'll turn it over to Mr. Hubinger.
Thank you.
Actually, Mr. Chair, I think it would be more appropriate to move to Mr. Watson.
Okay. Peter?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Peter Watson, and my voice is not my normal voice, and I apologize for not being able to speak in a softer tone. I'm Senate counsel, and I work for the Finance Committee and the Rules Committee and some other committees, and I put together a document that should be about the next one in your packet, talking about the history of the council's recommendations and what has happened to them in the legislature. The first page is just a repeat, basically, of what Mr. Bonner has told you. And on the second page, it starts going through the recommendation of each council. And what you'll notice as you go through here, I'm not going to cover all these, but what you'll notice is that the recommendations of the council have been taken seriously by the legislature, but they have often been modified, often to reduce them or delay them. The recommendations of the council that were made outside its statutory mandate, such as recommendations for an immediate increase in salaries for judges in July of the current year instead of waiting for 2 years, those recommendations have also been taken seriously, and often they have been implemented. Although, again, sometimes the percentage that the legislature has approved has turned out to be less than the percentage that the council recommended. When the council first met, they were focusing more on specific salaries of individual positions. But as the council moved into some later recommendations, you'll see in the 1989 they began talking about relationships of one to another. The salary of a Chief Justice of the Supreme Court was 110% of the salary of an Associate Justice, and so forth. That same pattern, if you'll turn another page or two, you'll see repeating itself, that the council has moved more and more toward establishing a relationship among the various positions under its control so that a change in one or a few salaries will cause the others to move relatively automatically. The constitutional officers back in 1999, and this is on the bottom of page 4, you'll see that the council recommended specific percentages that each be of the salary of the governor. And then if you turn to the next page, you'll see that those percentages were changed. I think those are the ones that are in effect now, the 95-85. Another thing that has interested the council, besides the relationships of the various positions, is what to do about inflation and what to do to get the compensation changes on a more regular basis, and doing something about this unfortunate fact that sometimes the recommendations are just not implemented, and so instead of going 2 years between changes, maybe it gets to be 4 or 6, so people get way behind. Is there something that could be done to provide a more regular, modest progression instead of having to go 10 years and then you have a huge jump from the old to the new salary? So one of the methods that the council has tried was in its recommendations for 2001, where they said, okay, we'll do the 5% each in the first year, and then do the lesser of the average of across-the-board increases received by state employees, or the CPI. Now, the state employees' salaries are collectively bargained. They're not set by the legislature. But they do generally come up with some kind of a pattern when everything is said and done, and there will be a percentage that could be applied. They're not all the same. There are different bargaining units, and some may get 5% and some 4 and some 3. So they vary, but there is an average. So the council has looked at, let's take the average of those, or maybe the lesser of those several different bargaining units, or the least of this bargaining units. Also interest in the CPI. There's been discussion in the council about other measures than the CPI, but that's been the one that's most frequently resorted. Turning to the next page, page 6, you'll see what the legislature did with those recommendations up on the top there, the 6.5, 6.5, 3, and 3, and then the percentages for the constitutional officers. Moving to the most recent recommendations, those are on the top of page 7 with the what the legislature ended up doing for the judges was 1.5%, but not waiting 2 years, doing it in the first year, the current year, July 1 of 05, and then July 1 of 06. The salaries for agency heads, I guess I haven't said much about those, but the council has looked at those relationships as well. There are currently about 2 or 3 different groups of agency heads, and the council has looked at which positions are in which group, the 85% group or the 75% group, and what should be those percentages. These are all percentages of the salary of the governor. The recommendations of this council, as maybe Mr. Bonner mentioned, would not take effect until the first Monday in January of 2009. Although, except for positions other than the legislators, they could be made earlier than that if so the council recommended and the legislature chose. Any questions?
Mr. Schoen?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Watson, unless someone else is going to do it, would you go over in some detail our recommendations from the 2005 council?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to. If you'll take a look at the bottom third of page 6, you'll see that the recommendation for the governor's salary was $137,869 starting in January of 07. But that was just based on inflation. Taking the last time the salary was changed in 1998 and just by applying inflation to the amount that was set at $120,000 back in 98, they came up with the $138,000 salary. Then they recommended, I think this may have been the first time that they recommended that salaries of legislators be set at a percentage, and they chose 33%. They had the salaries of judges increasing by 3 and 3 in 05 and 06, and then simply taking the CPI for all urban consumers as the inflation number for the 07 and 08. And they did not recommend anything with regarding to state agency salaries. Then you see on the top of page 7, as I mentioned before, what the legislature did with that. They basically cut the judges' increases in half and did not provide for the CPI increases for 07 and 08.
Or any of the other recommendations.
Right. It was only the judges who got anything last time around.
Just for my edification, who carried the legislation to increase the judges? Do you recall?
That would have been part of the public safety budget bill, and that would have been Senator Branham.
Was there any rationale to go to 1.5? Or
I don't know. I wasn't there.
Mr. Chair, I wasn't part of the committee at the time, but I would think that it was just budget constraints. I mean, they probably wanted to do something but couldn't fully do what they wanted to do and just should probably just cut it in half.
And was there any other meaningful consideration of salary increases in the last cycle?
Mr. Chairman, no. I mentioned this one change in the salary of the State Board of Investment in the, up near the top of page 7, that they took that position out of the limit to 95% of the salary of the governor and said, we'll have a compensation plan that's developed by the Board of Investment and submitted to the LCC and the legislature for approval. That's the same mechanism as is used for the collective bargaining plan and for the other compensation plans that are set by the Commissioner of Employee Relations. They are agreed upon, and then they are presented to the LCC Subcommittee on Employee Relations in the interim, which gives them interim approval. They go forward at that level, but their effectiveness is temporary. It's interim. There's always a bill introduced at that next session of the legislature to make the recommendations permanent, and if it's not passed by the end of the regular session, then those increases are not in effect anymore and they revert to the previous contract. I'm not sure that that's ever happened, but we really came close, and was it 03?
Mr. Chair, in the 01 session, the legislature did not ratify the labor contracts. They reverted to their previous levels. The administration executed new contracts to reestablish those terms and conditions of employment.
That would be awkward if you, in essence, dissolved all the labor contracts unionized employees?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. And what did it happen at the last day?
Mr. Chair, the legislature did not pass a bill ratifying the contract, so they were voided on the last day.
Okay. Are there any other questions of Mr. Watson?
What is the general path that your recommendations would follow? Is there some particular committee, state governments, or in the House or Senate, or how does this thing get out of here? Somebody has to come up and say, I'll carry a bill for you, or what?
Well, your cohort did it before from your hometown. I see your former colleague, Senator Terwilliger.
Okay, that's in the Senate.
In the past, he did it.
It was a few years ago.
But that's the only name I see in the memo. I mean, I'm just curious. Was there a reason to go to Terwilliger and point out that he meritoriously stood up to take the heat, or what?
He was the president.
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, the essential element first is that you have an agreement, yep, and you sign a letter, and I think Mr. Hubinger delivers it to the legislative leaders, and they take it from there. What's required to happen for something to happen is that somebody has to put some money into the budget bill. That they have to be paid for. Whatever you recommend, it's got to be paid for. And so those recommendations need to get to the budget committees before they're done making all of the budget decisions as a practical matter. But where the council is making additional recommendations outside its statutory mandate, then there needs to be a bill, and you need to find a friend of the legislature who might be one of the members of this commission, or it might be somebody else, to carry that bill. The usual reason for having a bill like Senator Terwilliger's may be a combination of a desire to do something beyond the statutory minimums, for example, those earlier increases for judges. Or it may be a desire to limit the increases to something less than or something different from what the council has recommended. There's often a lot of discussion about, okay, this is what the council recommended, but let's do something different. And so they put that into the form of a bill.
Does that answer your question? Mr. Staver?
Mr. Chairman and Peter, well, one of the things that recall in history with that is, of course, we had obviously the big deficit in that type of situation. But it did, as I read through this material, it always reiterated the fact that whatever we recommend has to be subject to appropriations. One of my curiosities is that with all of this tiered percentage increases and that type of thing, we've kind of built kind of a cascading arena here. Is there any way that we can get the appropriate type of information, at least in my mind, to have a significant number to gauge upon the impact of what these increases might do relative to the taxpayers of the state?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Stabler, yes, I'm sure there is. The collective bargaining agreements are always costed out. You're not dealing with nearly as many positions here.
Understand.
But there is a way to figure that out. Mr. Hubinger may know more than I do how they have done that costing out of these recommendations, but it certainly is a matter that can be done.
Mr. Chair and members, we haven't done that costing at this level, but we have done that when the recommendations of the council go to the finance divisions and they want some estimate about what the impact is going to be. We could at least do some back-of-the-envelope costing for this council.
I think it would be kind of imperative for our realization of impact to have some kind of sense of this cost.
Great. Mr. Swain?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Watson, you've been here since the beginning of this council, haven't you?
Yes.
Why did the council come into being?
Mr. Chairman, the legislators were looking for a way to get this issue of compensation out of politics. They thought it would be desirable to get a group that was not just legislators to weigh in on what was appropriate, so that it did not appear to be so self-serving when they were setting their own salaries.
And to not have such long gaps between adjustments.
Yes. A great desire to get away from that pattern, as had been in the past, that you go 5 or 10 years before any adjustments are made, and then they get to be whopping ones.
Are there further questions of Mr. Watson?
Chairman.
Yeah.
Mr. Watson, do we have any indication that, even though we're dealing with relatively few executive branch salaries, that somehow those are ceilings that are used as benchmarks for the negotiations?
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Meyerly, I don't think it really works that way. But what has happened in the past is that the collective bargaining has gone on, not with respect to what these recommendations have been. And what has happened is, I think, mostly the people at the bottom have been pushing up the people at the top rather than the people at the top pulling the people from the bottom.
Okay. Thank you.
Did we talk about, in some of the previous council discussions, the impact of the salary caps? I'm not sure whether we did, but it is a fact of life in this public employee compensation business that there is a series of laws that say that various salaries in state agencies are limited by the agency head. As a general rule, an employee of the agency can't get paid more than the agency head. And as a general rule, employees can't be paid more than 95% of the salary of the governor. And in, as I mentioned, in those various tiers of agency heads, there are some that are set down at 85 and 75. So there is a relationship that if you were to increase the governor's salary by a certain amount, there would be a lot of people who could move up. With regard to the agency salaries, head salaries, though, I think that there are hardly any who are at the top of their current range. Mr. Huminger, I think, will be coming up maybe the next thing with his chart of how those salaries are, but I think you'll see that the top of the range has not been a limiting factor on those salaries. They have been below the top of the range for years.
Mr. Swain?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Watson, that limit used to apply also to the heads of the Minsky system, doesn't it? And that's then since been repealed?
Mr. Swain, that's correct. And with Minsky, they did the same kind of thing as I described with the executive director of the State Board of Investment. That is, at some point, they said, we can't be hiring a president of the state university system for $114,000, which is about the 95% of the governor's $120,000. We just can't be hiring a system president for that kind of money. We've got to be able to go higher than that. And so they took it out of that system and had the board of MNSQ adopt a compensation plan that then was presented to the LCC, given interim approval, and so forth. So that there are those couple of ways that are outside this system. We've also had a law for quite a few years now, a couple of decades maybe, that has limited the salaries of local government employees to 95% of the salary of the governor. There is a system for permitting exceptions to that. Maybe I'm getting into Mark's testimony. Permitted exceptions to that for medical doctors and people with particular skills and with waivers granted by the Commissioner of Employee Relations. And another group, it seems to me, the school district superintendents got exempted from that salary cap some years ago, so that they now are paid more than $114,000, 95%. So we have these limits, but they're not uniform across the board, and they have caused some trouble both at the state and the local level.
Mr. Stabler.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Watson, one of the questions that comes to mind as we talk about salaries and relationships and maybe the relative level of salary types of things, but one of the questions I have then is, what has been, as far as the state is concerned, what has been the impact of turnover of key people, of qualified people? What type of difficulty have we had in recruiting and filling positions, that type of thing? And has there been any tendency that has directed itself? In other words, are we getting higher turnovers now than we did 10 years ago, or that type of thing? Or is there any kind of information that's available in that regard?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Stabler, yes, I believe there is. And it seems to me that 2 years ago, was it 2 years ago or 4 years ago, we had some testimony like that when we had the Commissioner of Employee Relations and maybe even the state labor negotiator. We had some key people from the executive branch come in and talk about their situation and their problems. I have no idea what the current situation is.
Yep. Okay. So we'll hear from them. Maybe they can visit in the testimony section. How's that? Are there other questions of Mr. Watts?
I apologize if I don't know how to read you, but I accept on some of the testimony.
Not at all. You've been here since, what was it, the present at creation?
No, I've worked for the Senate since 1971, so I was here when the council was created.
Present at the creation.
Yeah.
Okay. Greg, do you want to do it from here?
For one piece, Mr. Chair, there's a document in your folders, members, that is landscape that says salaries of Minnesota official, and it describes what Mr. Watson was doing narratively in a graphic form. It shows the salary history for each of the three groups for which the council is making salary recommendations. The constitutional officers are listed on the left side, and then we show the salary history for the last 10 years. The first is the governor's salary, which was last changed in 1998 as a result of a council recommendation in 1997 that was adopted by the legislature. And in that case, the governor's salary was increased by 2.5% in July 97, another 2.5% in January 98. It has not changed since then, despite several recommendations by this council. The other constitutional officers are listed next, the Attorney General, the Auditor, Secretary of State, and Lieutenant Governor. In 2003, the legislature adopted a recommendation of the council to set those salaries as a percentage of the governor's salary, following the pattern that Mr. Watson described. The next group includes the judges from the Supreme Court down to the district court judge level. And as you can see, the salaries for this group of constitutional officers has been increasing steadily over the last 10 years. The legislature has been more willing and able to implement some of the increases recommended by the council. The last two increases in July of 2005 and July of 2006 at 1.5% is half of what this council recommended 2 years ago. The council 2 years ago also recommended a cost of living adjustment that would have taken effect in the next 2 years that was not adopted. The last group consists of the legislators. Their salaries were last increased in January of 1999 to a level of $31,140, and they haven't changed since then either.
Are there questions of Mr. Hubinger?
Yes. Mr. Hubinger, what was the legislative salary increase from?
Mr. Chair and Senator Moore, there's a 5% increase, so I believe it was about
$29,000. Thank you.
Are there other questions of Mr. Hewitt? If not, maybe we can hear from Mark Shepard of House Research, talking about agency head salaries.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I won't take a lot of your time because some of the points I have in my memo you've already covered, so I'll just briefly review a couple of things. There's a memo, two memos in your packet. The first one is a topic that Mr. Watson mentioned briefly, which is other salaries that are affected by salaries within your jurisdiction. As Mr. Watson mentioned, the most important one is that you make recommendations for salaries of agency heads. And there's a statute that says that with some exceptions, the agency head salary is the limit of compensation within that agency. So the salary that you pick for the agency heads is the ceiling of compensation for the agency with certain exceptions. There are some miscellaneous other officials whose salaries are tied to or expressed as a limit, as a percentage of the governor's salary. Also, there's a number of the executive branch judges, the tax court, workers' compensation, administrative law judges, whose salaries are statutorily tied to a percentage of the judicial of salaries in the judicial branch. So if the legislature were to follow your recommendations and adopt new salaries for the executive for the judicial branch, then these executive branch judges would also get salary increases. And there's also some miscellaneous officials in the judicial branch whose salaries are affected by the salaries of judges. Salary of a state court administrator, district court administrator, for example, can't exceed the salary of a district court judge. So that's just for your background. You don't really act on those salaries, but what you do has some peripheral effect on those if the legislature adopts your recommendation. Also, as Mr. Watson indicated, the salary of a political subdivision employee is affected by the salary of the governor. This limit was changed recently. It used to be 95%. It was then set at 110%. It was indexed for inflation after that. So the current salary limit for local government employees is not a round number. It's $139,817. It's calculated by the Commissioner of Employee Relations annually. It is approximately 116% of the governor's salary at the moment. As Mr. Watson indicated, school district employees, some medical doctors and others are exempt from this totally, and there's a process for the Commissioner of Employee Relations to grant waivers from this. But the main point for your concern is that the salary of the governor does have some effect on many local government employees at the high end. A second topic I'm going to address briefly, Mr. Chair, is agency head salaries in your jurisdiction. As has been mentioned, you are required to submit recommendations for the salary ranges of the heads of state and metropolitan agencies. And Mr. Watson described the process for how that happens. In the memo that I have, there are I've listed the statute that assigns each of the major heads of state departments to a group. These most of them are limited at 95% of the salary of the governor, which is slightly over $114,000. Several are at 85%. And as has been indicated, most of these officials are not at that cap right now. Mr. Hubinger has a spreadsheet attached to the end of my memo on agency head salaries, which looks like this. And his spreadsheet shows the salary history for the agency head salaries. As you can see, most of the agency head salaries have not had an increase since August of 2000 and are currently paid $108,393. Mr. Chair, that concludes my remarks. I'd be happy to try to answer questions.
Are there questions of Mr. Shepherd? If not, thank you. We now come to the portion of our meeting where we take testimony from interested parties. We're a public body. We're on the record. We're wide open. And we're anxious to hear any and all who have something to say on this subject, hopefully in a controlled environment as opposed to the front page of the paper. Anyone? Yeah.
We had three individuals indicate that they wish to testify.
Okay.
Mr. Kelly, who's president of the Minnesota
State Bar
Association. Thank you.
Great.
Association. Sandy Murin from Messerly and Kramer, and Pat Anderson, the Commissioner of Employee Relations.
Terrific. Well, we'll take them in that order since that's how they came into you.
Yep.
How's that? Mr. Kelly?
Do you mind if we
come the duo. We're happy to have the duo. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the Compensation Commission, my name is Sandy Naren, and I'm here from Messerly & Kramer, but I'm here representing the Minnesota District Judges Association. That's an association of all the judges in the state, represents all 304 judges. Court of Appeals and Supreme Court also are voting members of the association. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you briefly about the issue of judicial pay. And there are a number of factors that I'd like you to take into consideration and respectfully request that you consider when making your decision about what to recommend on this issue. The typical attorney who, when appointed to the bench, has about 18 to 20 years of experience in the public or private sector. And the median age of judges who are now serving on the bench is about in the mid-50s with about 10 years on the bench. So when you compare the salary of a district court judge, you should be comparing it with someone who has about 30 years of experience practicing in either the public or private sector. While judges are state elected officials, we think that their service more closely mirrors those of public employees, because an individual who becomes a judge isn't engaging in public service for just a short period of time like some other elected officials do. Once they are appointed to the bench, most of them tend to stay there for the rest of their career, with only a few exceptions. Judges only receive increases in pay when the legislature expressly grants it, unlike judges in some other states who have formulas that automatically give them step increases or cost of living increases. Here in Minnesota, they have to be expressly granted by the legislature. And as some of the staff previously mentioned to you, the last raise given to judges was in July of 06. They are on schedule to receive no other raises unless expressly authorized by the current legislature. Judges' pay raises have historically been a little bit erratic in contrast to those given to other state employees. In your packet is a chart that shows the history of judges' pay in Minnesota. Raises sometimes are given for several years in a row, and then judges go several years without any raises at all. Back in the 1970s and 1980s, judges frequently went four-year periods with zero pay raises at all. In the 1990s, they went a four-and-a-half-year period without any raise at all. And also attached in your materials is a chart that Mr. Hippinger was kind enough to prepare for us previous years that shows the average across the board and step and merit increases that were given to two of the biggest unions in the state. Even though 100% of those employees don't receive all the step and merit increases that are on those charts, there is a notable contrast in the raises given to those employees compared to those of judges. One other factor that this commission has looked at in prior years when making the decision about what to set judicial pay at is the comparison with what judges in other states make. Historically, Minnesota judges have ranked in the high teens or so. We've never tried to be in the top 10 or number one. We've simply tried to at least keep them in the top 20 or so historically. But because of the years when there were no raises at all for judges back in the 1990s, judges fell to 35th in the country by 2001. Even behind Alabama and Mississippi, which wasn't very notable. The legislature,
perennial whipping states.
Absolutely. The legislature did grant some generous raises following that revelation, and that helped bridge the gap, and it brought judges back up to 18th in the country by July of 2004, which was a very respectable place to be, and judges were very content to stay there. When we testified before this commission in 2005, we voiced our satisfaction with where we were relative to judges in other states, and we asked the commission to recommend raises that would simply keep judges at that level and prevent them from sliding back down into the low 30s. And you did recommend raises of 3% for each of those 2 years, but the legislature, as was previously mentioned, only granted half of those raises. And we just checked with other states this morning and found out that we have now fallen to 28th in the country. So we are on our way back down. That's 10 ranks that we've fallen just in the last 2.5 years. Another factor that we would suggest that you consider in setting judicial pay is what private sector attorneys are being paid. There's also an article in your packet that was recently in the Minnesota Lawyer magazine that discussed the fact that major firms in the Twin Cities were paying first-year attorneys just out of law school with 0 years of experience $120,000 a year as starting salaries, virtually the same salary that a district court judge with 20 to 30 years of experience is now being paid. We're not suggesting that we should try and compete with salaries paid to the private sector, because the simple fact is we can't. But it is one factor that we hope you keep in mind, since it does affect, probably more than anything else, the diversity of applicants to the bench to begin with. Pat Kelly from the bar, who is here with me, will be discussing that issue in greater length. What I was most surprised to find since I testified last time around in 2005 is the growing disparity between judges and other people in the public sector. Last time I testified, I think there were a few elected county attorneys who made more than judges. Now, because of the local pay cap bill that passed the legislature in 2005 that raised local pay, we now have many assistant county attorneys and others who are making significantly more than judges are making. I found assistant county attorneys making $10,000 to $20,000 more than judges are making. And the most interesting piece is I found sheriffs who are now making more money than district court judges, and I don't recall that ever happening before. One other factor we asked you to consider is that when you go years with no raises and then you try and grant larger increases to compensate for that, it does have an adverse impact on the judge's pension fund. Judges who retire then following big increases in pay end up taking a pension benefit without having paid years of the benefit for that, and it does wreak havoc in the fund. That for that reason, the pension fund directors have encouraged regular incremental increases to employee salaries to even out the impact on the pension funds, and they have testified to this in previous years. We have good reason to be proud of our judiciary in Minnesota. We have one of the hardest working judiciaries. Minnesota trial court judges handle over 2 million cases a year here in Minnesota. The legislative auditor did a very extensive audit of the court system several years ago and concluded that judges in Minnesota handle 49% more cases than judges in comparable states. And according to some national surveys that have been done occasionally from year to year, Minnesota has always ranked in the top five when they evaluate judges for fairness and for competence. So we should be very proud of the judges we have here. We're very, very fortunate. The judiciary's requested recommendation to the Comm Council this year is included in your packet, and we're asking you to recommend actually a four-step increase for judges. We're asking you to make recommendations for this current biennium, which can be granted for judges. Unlike legislators, you can give immediate increases, and this is comparable to what we are asking the legislature for. We are asking for 5% raises for July this year, for July of next year. That is our attempt to try and catch back up and raise us out of 28th in the country and hopefully get us back around 18 or 20. And then we're asking you to implement a formula increase for judges for the 2 years following that, for 2009 and 2010, that would be tied to what the state employees unions received for increases in those years. The previous comp councils have made recommendations for 4 years at a time, and we have passed legislation in previous years that have tied judges' pay to what union-negotiated pay has been granted. So that's what our request is. I thank you for the opportunity to speak with you, and I want to introduce Pat Kelly now, who is president of the Minnesota State Bar Association and has been kind enough to agree to come speak to you tonight also.
Great.
Thank you.
How about it?
Good evening. On behalf of the Minnesota State Bar, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you tonight. The State Bar represents approximately 16,500 attorneys within this great state. We support the recommendations that is just expressed. One of the basic elements that you can take pride in is that the Minnesota judges are well known for their competency and the amount of caseload. And this is a direct impact of getting quality people to apply for judicial positions. And one of the aspects of the Minnesota lawyer article indicated starting salary. Now, it's extreme with large law firms at about $120,000. But as you look at it, at the earning capacity of a judge that is active and the usual application, it's in the age bracket of about 50 at the height of earning capacity. Judges have never, as I travel the state and appear in different courts, they're not complaining about salary. But they work very, very hard. They're professionally dedicated to the profession, to the rule of law and constitution. The key is quality people. And to get those quality people, when you get into this element is, am I going to make this commitment at the height of my earning career to get onto the bench? So far, it's excellent results. I can't stress. I just finished a trial in Hastings, and we were involved in complex contract action, 3-day trial. In between that, the judge held sentencings on criminal matters, just shifted gears, And that person was on the bench for approximately 15 years, but shifted gears right in the middle of the trial and said, gentlemen, we're going to take a break here because I have to handle the sentencing issue. That competence issue came into play of the ability to take the criminal aspects, apply the law correctly, and then go back into a contract case, which was long and complex. I think what you want to look at, too, is that Oliver Wendell Holmes once said, greatness is not so much where we stand as in what direction we are moving. We must sail sometimes with the wind and sometimes against it, but sail we must, and not to drift and not lie in anchor. And one thing with the judiciary is that there has to be, and you've done a well in recommending increases, but some stability there. That you know, let's settle this and get into a mode of saying that from a non-political view, which you are charged with it, but get some compensation, some increases, and then tie it, as Sandy indicated, to some factor. It's the other aspect that sometimes we don't see is that the amount of volunteer time judges place within the community. And I've experienced this in the last 4 years, that they go out into the community, into the schools, and talk about the judiciary and talk about the system of government, which we all benefit from. And it's very common they have a Supreme Court judge out at a school or out of a community function, which is important to all of us, explaining their function and also the function of state and law. Catherine Mathis, who's the president, current president of the ABA, said that we are at the point where the erosion of pay is clearly discouraging the best private lawyers from entering the judiciary, and increasingly judges are leaving the bench. And that was a very good question. Part of their career because of financial pressures or because of that benefit? And that was I thought about that, trying to think about, you know, judges that are in there and they're dedicated. And they are dedicated. But there are situations where the private sector will try to entice them to come back and say, you know what, you could be making more in this section than the public sector. And they do have financial issues. Finally, in closing, again, I thank you for your time. The founders of our nation and our state wisely understood that financial security is essential to protect judges from manipulation. And that was way back when. We need to ensure that we stay true to that wisdom. And on behalf of the State Bar, thank you for your time and dedication and taking over this effort. Thank you.
Questions?
Mr. Stanek.
Thank you very much, both of you, Mr. Kelly and Ms. Nairn, for your testimony. Ms. Nairn, in your testimony observed, and thanks for materials from Minnesota Lawyer, Fagering, Benson, Dorsey and Whitney, Lindquist and Benham, Oppenheimer, all paying first-year associates $120,000. You made the observation that's basically the same as district court judges who are paid slightly more. And I don't mean to put you on the spot, but would you care to offer any observations or comment on the fact that that's basically the same salary as the governor of the state of Minnesota and is approximately $6,000 more than the state's chief legal officer, the attorney general, as well as the state auditor, fiscal watchdog? Care to offer any observations?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Stanek, I think those positions are underpaid also. I think the Attorney General and the Governor are very underpaid for what they do. One distinction, of course, that I made during my testimony was those people come into public service usually for a brief period in their life. They are not career people, generally speaking. We don't have many governors who stay around forever. Judges, once they become judges, and some of them become judges in their 40s and stay for 5 years, some even more, they are career people, and I think that is one distinction should be made here.
Mr. Chair, could I have one more question?
Sure.
My recollection of the history of the gubernatorial pay increases is that there was some controversy or hesitancy to raise the salary of the governor. That is the governor who came between Governor Carlson and prior to Governor Plenty. Is that your recollection as well? That that clouded some of the compensation discussion related to the governor's office.
Mr. Stanek, I do recall there being some controversy about that a number of years ago, and some governors appearing and saying they did not want to increase that pay.
And Mr. Chair, I know we'll get to comment later, but I think one of the points to keep in mind is that I've always viewed the work of this council as being having very little to do with current occupants of these offices and more of us coming together as citizens to try to determine what's right for these positions. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, I do have one answer to the question that was previously asked about the pay raise from last time around. When the two judiciary finance bills went to conference committee, the House version of the bill did give judges pay raises comparable to what this council had recommended. The Senate had zero in their conference in their bill that they took to conference, and I think the 1.5% might have been the compromise. Halfway.
Mr. Chair? Just to comment while these two witnesses are up here, one way to look at it is that first-year associates at the top law firms are getting $120,000 a year. The other way to look at it, we don't have the numbers in front of us, is it was alluded to, a lawyer who is a partner in one of these firms and is earning probably 3-4 times that amount per year, and looking at the prospect of going down to a first-year associate's salary level in order to take a judgeship is making a very, very significant financial sacrifice for the long term, not only for themselves but for their families. And at that age, they might very well have children entering college as well. So the highest demand in their personal financial needs are approaching as they are at the point of considering perhaps a career status increase in some ways to a judgeship, but a significant financial decline. And for that reason, we've got terrific judges throughout the system, I think there are a lot of potential judges out there who just are not willing to make that sacrifice. I don't know if we'll ever catch up to the point where, and I don't know that we ought to necessarily catch up to that point, but we ought at least to strive to make it not quite such a huge financial sacrifice if we want to continue to get the top lawyers in the state in line for judgeships.
Mr. Chair? I will tell you that anecdotally I've been told by members of our Merit Selection Commission that the number of applications for judges has decreased over the last number of years, and that they're seeing an increasingly high percentage of more public sector attorneys applying for this. So there is a change that is having an effect, as Senator Lance has indicated.
Mr. Swain.
Mr. Chair. To add to that, I also served on the Judicial Merit Selection Committee in the First District for, what's it started? It's its inception. I'm not a lawyer, I'm a public member, and it was my experience over the course of time to be very impressed by the level of applicants. But it was also clear, consistent with what Senator Lance was observing, that many of the applicants were either relatively fresh and inexperienced attorneys who might be looking for something they perhaps weren't quite prepared for, or guys not quite my age but getting close that had other ideas of how comfortable being a judge might be, and they clearly were out of it. We saw very few that it was clear that they would be making this kind of a sacrifice. I can remember a couple and was quite impressive, but you're very clear that there's a significant gap there. I don't know if we can ever bridge it totally, but we certainly must keep trying.
Any other questions? If not, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Anderson? Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Pat Anderson, Dewar Commissioner. I'm here. I'll give a very brief testimony, and then I'm here mostly to answer your questions, which I there's some that you gave and I could answer in my testimony. I'll speak briefly. I did speak to the governor's office about this issue when I realized the meeting was coming up. We did not speak about the judge issue, so the governor does not have a position on that. His position on his own salary, which relates to everything else, is no change, which is the same position that we had 2 years ago. There are many things that are linked to the governor's salary, as we've as you've been discussing, not only agency heads, not only legislators, but people all across state government. And we haven't run the numbers, but there is a cost. And while our budget is better this year than it was 2 years ago, we still don't have a lot of money out there. And so that's the governor wanted me to relay that to you and to tell you that his position is to no change in his salary and the other salaries that are linked to his. So I can answer questions. Questions?
Mr. Swain.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Anderson, I take it that with the level of compensation for agency heads, for the most part, not crowding the limits, that everything is comfortable and satisfactory there insofar as obtaining qualified people to serve in these important positions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Swain, I think that most of the agency heads are comfortable with their positions, and I hope that we are, or our salaries, and I hope that we are good candidates for those positions. There was a question about compression that's very real. You have that data that is has been compression at the top. It's not with the agency heads. It's with those right below the agency heads, and they're sort of bumping up or at the agency head salary. But I don't think that there's been issues finding qualified people to run the agencies.
May I? Sure.
Well, then to the next level, is that issue being accelerated, this question of compensation for subordinate positions to agency heads? The crowding, is it getting worse? Ability to attract, keep people in important management positions?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Swain, the crowding has become worse. I know there's something in your packet related to that. I believe it's in this packet. Is that correct? The crowding has become worse. It's not to a point where it's a serious issue at this point. I think there's 60-some people or something that would be affected if there was a change in the agency head salary, whereas there were very few 4 or 5 years ago. So I can't speak to whether there's been issues across state government attracting people to those second-level positions, but in my experience, there hasn't been.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Chairman.
Are we live here, Mr. Chairman?
I believe so.
Are we taping this or what?
I believe so.
And I want the message to get through. I'm aware, Mr. Chairman, in the transportation department, they have this compression. They're losing valued and skilled employees to the private sector, as the judges are doing. We have the same attitude toward. I carried the legislation to raise the salaries of local, the ability to raise the local government officials, the city managers, and so forth. And it was the same attitude then. You almost had to break arms to make people in the administration understand what the hell is happening. And it really makes me angry that we've got this no new tax thing running through us right again. You will carry that message, won't you? Yes. Well, anyway, I mean, I think we ought to lay back a few things here and call in maybe one of the former deputy commissioners is now in the private sector earning more money. They're losing people there to county government, for instance. Their engineers are going out. They're losing their skilled people. And if we ever get any money for transportation, there won't be anybody there to run programs. And I think this is ridiculous. You carry that message back to them, will you?
Thank you, Representative.
And while I'm on the phone here, Mr. Chairman, we've got
hiring legislators to run for this office out of college, which sounds lovely, and maybe it's okay for a couple of years, and they get married, and they have, you know, that's the second term they're here, and then the third term they have their first baby, and they bail out of here. And this is ridiculous.
Actually, that's a little too close to home, Chief.
Yeah. Or you get people on the other end of the spectrum, like myself, who have made a little money in the private sector and now have spent, in the last 16 years, $150,000 out of my 401 because I like this work. You know, I don't expect that we're going to earn, as legislators, what we could earn in the private sector. But stamps have gone up four times since we got a salary increase, and I think that this has got to be addressed to no Mr. Tax, no new taxes. I don't mean to be outspoken, of course. I never am.
It wouldn't be the same meeting without it.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, can I make an observation? Representative, if I'd like the council to think about, we raised the salaries of the, or we raised the cap for the local government folks a year or two ago, and if there was any sort of raise that happened at the state level, that would have to be taken into account, obviously. You have locals who are now linked to the governor's salary, so if there was any raise in the governor's salary, that link is going to become out of whack. And that it would need to be completely thought through. Not that I'm not proposing anything. I just want to remind the committee that they need to remember that and take that into account. Or you'll have local government salaries that are at a place that you wouldn't want them to be.
Why is that?
They're set at 100. Right now they're set at 116% approximately of the governor's salary.
Maximum.
But it goes up with inflation every year.
Right. That was the struggle.
So local government folks are more highly compensated than state government folks because they're all tied to the governor's salary at different rates.
So if the governor's salary went up,
theirs
would
go up.
What are you cautioning us about?
If the governor's salary would go up, theirs would also go up to 116% of whatever the governor's salary.
The potential to go up would be there.
It would if you didn't change the law. Does that make sense?
I think there's input from the crowd.
Mr. Chairman?
Sure.
And I think Mr. Shepard can speak to this in more detail. It's also in his memorandum. The percentages set in law are set as caps. They're not. Mm-hmm. In other words, it would be within the discretion of the local unit to increase the salary to that limit.
They understand.
But it would not automatically increase.
Right. Let me comment on one other thing. School district employees are... it was in 96, I believe, that they were removed from the cap. And there are a number of school district employees that are over the governor's salary. Mostly it's in superintendents and top management and so on. And there was an argument made 2 years ago when the local government argument was made as to why were they different than local government officials. And there was discussion at that point of bringing them back under the cap, or treating them the same, shall we say, as a county administrator or county manager. So you do have these discrepancies right now. But the fact is right now what's in law, many, many things, unless you're exempt from the cap, are linked to the governor's salary. So if there was a raise in the governor's salary, you would have the potential for raising all across government, across both state and local government here in Minnesota. Just as many things are linked to commissioner salaries, those within the agencies. And because of that, those issues, that's why the governor is recommending no change.
Mr. Chairman?
I think it was Ms. Hammer first.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, Pat, the previous council had recommended linking legislative salaries to the governor's salary as well, and although it wasn't approved, I'm wondering, is the governor also saying that he recommends no change in salaries for legislature as well?
That's correct. My discussions with the governor is no change in salaries, period. We did not talk about judges, though. It was not separate, shall we say.
Mr. Shepard?
I'd like to remind the committee the Senate just recently, about a month ago, passed large changes in per diem rates to increase their compensation that way. So you have a salary, but you also have per diems, and it was a considerable raise in per diem on the Senate side.
Senator Lance, who was next?
I'll defer to Mr. Swain. Before.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Anderson, I sure understand you. You indicated the governor was comfortable with the level of his current salary. And that would then automatically affect those who are tied to him, the other constitutional officers. Did he expressly state that no change is warranted in his judgment for legislative salaries?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Swain, his express quote was something having to do with Nancy Reagan, which is the just say no theory. And so it was across the board as to what we were discussing. We never brought up the, we did not discuss judges in particular, but it's legislators, agency head, constitutional officers, and everything else is linked to that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Latz.
Ms. Anderson, how does the governor account in his recommendation for cost of living increases that all employees, legislators, governor, other constitutional officers, agency heads have to deal with in their day-to-day lives?
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, we did not discuss that. We did not discuss cost of living issues.
So, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Anderson, then there's something else motivating the governor to want to keep salaries at the same level, other than recognizing the costs of living have increased for all of those categories, just like they have for judges and for other employees in state government and other levels of government?
Mr. Chair and Senator Latz, I believe the governor believes, and he stated it before, that he believes that the high-level public employees are paid well, not just the elected officials at his level, but also commissioners and top managers. And he believes that we need to live within our means, and our means mean that if you're paying, getting a six-figure salary, that you don't need a six-figure plus 6% salary.
Mr. Chairman, I might respond to the issue relating to Senate per diem. If you had gone back to when the last time was that the Senate per diem was increased and you averaged the increase out over those years, it was on average about a 4% per year increase. It seemed like a big jump because salaries had been frozen, or per diems had been frozen for so long, just like the salaries for legislators have been frozen for so long. Perhaps we'd be better off making incremental smaller increases on a regular basis to recognize that the price of stamps goes up. I don't think it's fair to treat these employees any differently than any other employee in any level of government, or for that matter in the private sector, where they're also getting, typically they're getting some compensation increases. More of a comment than not necessarily requiring a response.
Other questions?
Mr. Stabler?
Chairman, Mr. Chairman, and Pat, and to the Senator, what specifically were the per diem changes? From what to what?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Stabler, the Senate increased the maximum per diem from $66 per day to $96 per day. It's at the discretion of each senator whether to take that per diem increase.
A wise legislator always made sure that he was not the top of the chart unless he didn't really care about how he's perceived.
Okay.
I would just observe that was.
Mr. Chairman, the House was 66 to 77. That was their increase. So there was a difference between the two bodies.
Mr. Stabler?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, in a comment, I guess, that seems functionally fundamental to me in terms of the service that we are called as citizens to do here. And in one of the primary issues, and I recall some conversations in prior sessions to that effect, is that a fundamental issue, as I understand our Constitution, is that we wanted to have the challenge to have a citizen legislature has always been about us. And to argue, from my perspective at least, and the people that I live with and listen to and the business world, to move the compensation of our legislators to justify a full-time supportive wage, as I think was being referenced here and has have in the past, is significantly a mistake in my mind to this whole impact of a citizen legislature. The people of at least rural Minnesota like the fact that their legislators have to come back and live with them and continue to provide for their families, not only from the compensation that they're getting for the public service that they've rendered themselves to, but also the fact that they are a participant in our society, a participant in our economic system. And therefore, a 46% increase that was discussed and passed in our last session seems disproportionately justified in the sense of that is not the career that we had intended when we formulated our state, that to be a legislator.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I've been sitting here thinking a lot, and this is from someone in the context of reading the article. You know, the law firm where I was formerly an associate with is one of the law firms in the article. And so I'm looking at the salaries of an entry-level associate as being a former associate in one of those law firms. Maybe I made the wrong choice. But that doesn't eliminate the fact that I think in this room we would acknowledge that my decision to come to the Minnesota legislature has benefited the people of the state in some ways. And I think, you know, the discussion about compensation and pay is not really so much what's on the piece of paper. I like to think that those of us who choose, and I chose to, although some would argue that I have publicly made the statement that if I knew that I was going to get elected, I might not have run. but you know, we chose to participate in the public process because I think not for sure because of the salary, not for sure. And in this day and age, I for sure not necessarily because of the fame or the power that comes with it. I mean, I think that people who go into public life, given the state of where the public pay is at, really come into this with other goals in mind and other rationales in mind. And so when those of us who are directly affected by it engage in this kind of discussion, it puts us in an awkward spot to seem like we're being self-serving and trying to fight for something that is going to benefit us. And I like to impart to this group that at the end of the day, I think it is really, the discussion is really less about who gets how much money, but it is fundamentally about respect for our public servants. And it is fundamentally about creating and inculcating that sense of respect among the public for public life, for public life. If we cease to place a certain level of importance to the role of our judges in their role as our judiciary, we wouldn't be able to attract the kind of talent that would perpetuate what we hold to be so sacred in our separation of government system. And if we don't start to talk about public life and participation in public life in terms other than dinking over a $10 or a $15 per diem increase, I think that in the long run, it isn't so much who wins or who loses the political battle today, depending on who's in the different branches of government. But I think at the end of the day, it is a really fundamental issue about how our citizens perceive public officials and public life. And I just want to add this one last thing, is that I understand that the public, when this state was created, and when we created our governing system, and when we created our legislature, I think that nobody can argue, it is a fact, that the state of Minnesota was in a very, very different place. Every day when I sit in that Senate seat, that doesn't fit me. And I have to have a stepping stool built so that I don't hurt my back. I am very well aware that chamber was not built for people my size. They were built for more your size. And so I'm reminded that our state has changed a lot. And the needs of our state have changed a lot. And the matters that are up for consideration in this state has changed a lot. And every single day when we have issues that come across our desk, you know, whether that is as legislators or as agency heads, it takes people with talent and with particular skills to help craft that. So as much as we want to think that our legislature was crafted for the citizen legislator, I think that when we think about who people want to elect or to put up there in the job to do the work, there is some consideration given to that individual's background and their ability and the capacity to do the work. And some of that has to come into play because of the complexity of the issues that we have to address every single day. There's no doubt that a talented attorney like a Senator Latz and his ability to contribute to the discussion in a judiciary committee is so fundamentally important to the citizens of this state. And so it is just as important to have the context of the discussion about attracting really talented lawyers from both the public life and the private life into the judiciary. I think that we ought to give some thought to the discussion about, you know, how do we make this a kind of life not based purely on salary, but how do we make this the kind of life that would attract really young or really mature or really talented people who want to bring their talent and skills. And at the end of the day, I guarantee you that when people think about what they want to do in public life, they don't think about the money, but they think about the public perception of who we are. And in the 5 years that I've been here at the legislature, all too often, everything that we do, the hard work, the long nights, the 12, 13, 14-hour days, get reduced to the very shallow headlines about how much the Senate wants a per diem raise or how much, you know, the House wants a per diem raise. And when we do that, we're directly participating and perpetuating, creating a deep sense of disrespect, not for us as individuals elected officials, but a deep, deep disrespect for the institutions that are so critical to this state. And so, you know, as we move forward and as we talk about compensation, particularly with respect to public figures, I mean, I hope that we would take that into consideration, because clearly, maybe I'm still young and naive, but I feel like many people who go into public life come into it with something other than obviously the compensation. But at the same time, people have to feed their families, and so we should think about that. But in the long run, it's the tone and it's the way we talk about the compensation that will matter a whole lot in helping to shape the kind of public respect that we need to have, not for the individuals, but for the institutions that we represent.
Thank you.
We heard from the Senate. Can I expound from the House for a moment, Mr. Chairman?
Please do.
Well, I don't believe that anybody who is around here in the job of a legislator believes that this is a citizen legislature any longer. The demands are almost year-round. The people expect, you know, I try and come over at least once a week in the off, maybe twice, because people are wondering where I am if I'm not that answering my phone or returning their calls. And I don't live in Perham, Minnesota. I live in a high-tech area, the Edina, Minnesota. Not the highest, because I think you live in a higher one. But nevertheless, I have expensive housing, although minimal, and property taxes that are run right along with the valuation. And just I happen to be looking at the legislative salaries across the country a week or two ago. The top salary, and I think it was from 2005, was $110,000 in California, but that is not a citizen, that's a professional legislator. And I think Minnesota was either 17th or 27th. I cannot remember quite what, wherever. And there's some other little factors here that per diem, if you live within 50 miles of the capital, you get taxed on it. So out of that $66 per diem that we were getting, my take-home was $36. Those folks that live without 50 miles take the full amount, and which was 66 at that time, and are not taxed. So there's a lot of mix in here. If you're not a legislator and you live in rural Minnesota, that doesn't necessarily apply across the board. Thank you.
There you go. Are there any other questions of Ms. Anderson? If not, thank you so much.
Mr. Chairman,
could I
just a thought or two follow up? Senator Mua said it far more eloquently than I could have. I want to take a slightly more practical approach. I don't think it's appropriate to talk about percentages. I think we ought to be talking about absolute numbers that seem fair. I know the public perception is we raise per diems 45% or whatever it is, 50%. But, you know, we talked about salary proposals in the past of 45% increases. I wasn't around during that time, but that's what Mr. Stabler referenced. But, you know, the actual dollar amount, my legislative assistant makes almost as much as I do. My legislative assistant makes within $1,000, I think, of what I get paid.
It's any consolation. In my first term, my legislative assistant made more.
Okay. Well, then you get my point, Mr. Chair. You know, I lose money every day I'm in the Senate. I do, because I'm not taking my new client calls in my private law practice. And if they don't get me, they go on to the next lawyer that they can find from whatever reference source they're trying to find a lawyer. I can tell you, I won't be here when my kids are in college because I won't afford it. I just couldn't afford it. And it is a year-round job. There's no question about that. This may be a citizen legislature, but we didn't take a vow of poverty to come here to serve the people of Minnesota. If it is a matter of perception, then there was a new member of the Senate when all this debate was hitting the media about the per diem increases. And her husband started asking around her smaller town of Minnesota, a minor regional center, I guess might be the way to characterize it, and started asking some people in the area, what do you think a senator should be making in Minnesota? What do you think they're, no, not what should they, what do you think they are getting paid? And they were responding, oh, $50,000 a year. And then he tells them, well, they get paid $31,000. Really? It's a surprise. They think the perception is that we ought to be being paid more because of the responsibilities associated with this position. And I'm not suggesting that we raise the pay to $50,000 a year, but what I am saying is we should be a little realistic and a little respectful of the office and not just pretend that inflation doesn't exist. Not worry about percentages, because a lot of that is catch-up over 8 years of inactivity, and pay a little more attention to the actual dollar amounts that might fairly reflect the responsibilities that we have, the positions that we have. And someday, someone's going to run for my Senate seat after I retire. I'm sure someone will run for my Senate seat before I retire. And in the big scheme of things, we want people who are qualified to serve in these positions to be willing to come into these positions. And we don't want the salary levels to be a disincentive to that happening, or the quality of public policy ends up suffering in the end.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Mr. Durda.
My comments are going to come from 2 years ago when they started to gestate. Because the discussion is interesting, but again, my perspective is about as far from the political arena as you can get. As understood a little earlier, I couldn't even remember. I had no idea what congressional district I was in. But again, the system within which you're operating, you've got legislators, career professionals, judges, all mixed in the same. And I'm mindful of a comment that surfaced a long time ago at Cornell during a conference when we had some distinguished people, Dr. Milkovich was one of them, commented over that any system that ignores market will eventually be dismantled by its own weight. That's what you're dealing with. You already have exceptions popping up. 2 years ago when I put my hand up and said, "What is there a compression study done? And are you at all looking at whether or not you're getting a second or third level of candidate into the professional ranks?" That's not even done. This system entirely ignores market, and market's overtaking it, is what's happening. Now, why say that? There will be, as this body is put together, recommendations within the confines of the current system. Should be. But it doesn't say that we can't, as a group, also consider recommendations beyond that, which says, and I don't know how this is done, a legislature then puts together a commission, but somewhere along the line, there's going to have to be a longer-term solution to this. And that solution is to find out how it interfaces with the market. And again, for me, this is extremely awkward, because my 30 years says the market drove it. And we found ways to incorporate the market into the system. This system ignores the market except for a job here and, oh, yes, the school administrators, and then, of course, you've got this one here for the investment people. You will find that more and more, and I would be comfortable saying that your compression problem has doubled in the 2 years. It'll be even more so. And I would also say that this state, you know, from a corporate standpoint, you say, well, why do you want to be comparable with the market? Because you want to be the best. Well, we don't want to be the best. And there isn't even a philosophy here as to where we want to be. And I talked about, we're the 18th, we're the 19th. Well, what do you want to be? Do you want to be in what quartile do we want to be in? Again, my only thoughts are that, going back 2 years, that I would encourage colleagues here to suggest that we would offer an additional recommendation in writing to the legislature to say, put together a commission, long-term study on how you're going to change the system. Because this system right now is archaic, it ignores the market, and it will break down. Now, that's opinion, but it comes with some measure of experience.
We're in the discussion phase, and that's absolutely appropriate. Thank you. Mr. Swain?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Glatz, having been around in this compensation council for lots of years, it's become very clear that the political sensitivity of the legislature dealing with and voting on their own salaries is almost insuperable. And it was a legislator who was on the commission last year that offered this concept of a percentage of the governor's salary that looked to some of us like, perhaps not immediately, but a longer term, a more practical and easier solution to adjusting legislative pay. That's why the council accepted that, made that recommendation. I don't know if the number was right. And you seem to feel that percentages just don't do the job. Just wanted you to understand how we got there, or whatever longer term merit it might have.
Mr. Chair,
perhaps
I was misunderstood. That's not the kind of percentage reference that I was concerned about. It's percentage increases that I get nervous when we start talking about, when we talk about it was a 45% increase over the existing salary level. That's a totally misleading reference when it reflects a 10-year catch-up.
So I'm not
as concerned about linking it necessarily as a percentage of, say, the governor's salary. If we recognize that cost of living goes up for the governor, well, maybe not. He gets a house. We don't get a house. But for those of us for whom the cost of living does go up, we should get that report. And a car. Doesn't it?
Oh.
Pay for his own gas. So.
E85.
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Swain.
Hey, you've been here before. We must act before.
May 1.
No. When is the last day for appropriation bill introduction?
It's an April sometimes.
Mr. Chair and members, I believe that to be helpful, the recommendations would be needed by in the Finance Committees by the 15th of April.
Not before. 15th will do it? From a practical standpoint, when do we need to get this done?
Mr. Chairman, we have the ideal and then we have the real.
What'd you say, the ideal and the deal?
And the real. Ideally, the committee would have been appointed and started its work months ago and submitted its recommendation by, say, the 1st of March or the 15th of March. Because in the Senate, the appropriation process is moving forward, and the committee that does at least some of this work, the State Government Committee, had its final decision on their budget today. The committee that does the judges, the Judiciary Finance Division, is up, I think, tomorrow. So on the Senate side, they've made their decisions already. The House is on a different schedule, and the April 15th may work out fine for putting something in a House bill. Depending on the reaction of the members to the recommendations, they can find a way to take advantage of those recommendations anytime until May 21st.
So what are you saying? When should we get this done to have any kind of relevancy? Are we already irrelevant?
Well, Mr. Chairman, no, I don't think you're irrelevant. I think you need to work on a schedule that is aggressive, but something that you can accomplish. And if that means April 15th, as Mr. Hubinger suggested, that may work out just fine.
Mr. Chair,
to me,
the real practical issue builds a little bit on Mr. Derda's comments. I don't know what additional data, facts, charts, surveys would help us in the relatively short time frame that we're facing, whether we're looking at doing something by April 1st or April 15th. And most of us have been in this discussion process at least once or twice before. And I don't think I've gained necessarily a whole lot of wisdom in the last 2 years on this process. So my inclination is leaning towards looking critically at what we did from a policy point of view with our previous report, accepting the recommendation of the Bar Association and the district court judges, because I think particularly we have probably the most hard data and the most good experience with the salaries of our judges and work in that regard. I would like to make a slight reflection on a countervailing point to some of the previous comments that we've made. You know, I'm fortunate to work in a world-class organization. It happens to be a nonprofit. I have a colleague whose daughter is going to be starting as a first-year associate in a New York law school or a New York law firm, and her starting salary is higher than my corporate general counsel's salary. My organization does do salary surveys, and we try to keep ourselves in the upper third to be competitive. But a lot of us choose to work in a corporate law department or in public service for a lot of factors other than just the salary. We have to have an adequate salary, as has been said, to fund things that we want to do, including our future and our children's future. But I do think we cannot distill this down just to a dollars and cents calculation, that there are other considerations that do go into why people choose to do certain salaries. And I continue to be amazed, Mr. Kelly, that law, I think, has the widest band of salary ranges of any profession that I know. And when I have high school students and college students coming to me and saying, gee, should I go to law school or should I do something like that, we have a really frank discussion about the compensation that challenges that they're going to be facing. So I think we all come to this with lots of motivations, and the struggle we're going to have here is, with the limited amount of information that we have, picking something that's going to keep us moving forward in what I would like to see, a slope fashion rather than the step fashion that has been so fits and starts for much of what we do here.
We've had wide-ranging testimony. We've had wide-ranging discussion. Sandy, were you able to find a date for our next meeting?
Mr. Chair, it looked like Tuesday, March 27th at 4 p.m. is most popular.
Okay.
May I ask a question, Mr.
Sure.
Chairman?
What
is a slow fashion in time? What do you mean by that? Are you talking months or weeks or days? Or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, I think one of the recommendations I'd like to see us add to this group is to pick up on what Mr. Watson said, that I think we need to have a very serious consideration given to how we professionalize the way in which we look at things, instead of just saying, historically, this is what we've done, we've made recommendations, the legislature has disposed of those recommendations in various ways, and do start this process so that we're not asking when's our deadline, we're able to ask what information do we need and how can we get it in a reasonable time to allow us to consider it.
Mr. Chairman, is it possible we go on a dual track so we can accomplish what we need to for the finance units of the House and Senate and move ahead on the suggestions that we're hearing?
Well, sure. I think as you read the memos, you know that as a practical matter, our end date is May 1, correct? When we're technically out of business. I don't think there's anything that prevents us from meeting and making recommendations in the immediate term to meet our statutory obligation. There are a number of us who have been around this discussion for years. Pretty clear that it's a cumulative process. And there are a lot of different component parts.
I haven't been here, but I've been thinking about you.
Okay. Mr. Swain.
If March 27th is the date of the next meeting, is it realistic, given some of the constraints that have just been outlined, that we would have on that day make some kind of final initial recommendations insofar as the what the law imposes upon this group to do? If so, how might we expedite it in the interim? People submitting suggestions to you or to Mr. Hubinger? Or
I think they submit them to Mr. Hubinger, and I'll be in touch with him, and I'll look at the lay of the land and check in with the various members and see if we have any consensus. How's that?
Sounds good to me. That then anticipates that we will, given the tight deadlines, hopefully reach some kind of conclusion on the initial side of this at the next meeting.
You know, these guys have all this time, not that they've dispatched with the regents.
It's just a tiny issue of conference committees, Mr. Chair.
I know a little bit about conference committees and agree. Are you suggesting something?
Nope. This is the best route to go. I think we should go forward, and other things should try to fit in or accommodate it, Mr. Chair.
Great. Are there... Mr. Stabler.
Mr. Chairman, in trying to be pragmatic and sensitive and aware of the 46% increases as numbers and that type of thing, if we are ever to attain... you know, what I would call a pragmatic view as opposed to the political view, which kind of connotes the origin of our committee, taking it off of the lap of the legislature directly and passing it into an independent organization. How can we effectively make a decision next meeting if, in fact, it's going to be based on the categorical political agendas that we've all been enthroned with over the past years and the historical aspect of this, as opposed to the issue of a compression study, the issue of some of the analyticals, the turnover rates, the factual turnover rates in these positions, some of the issues of recruiting new people. It seems like these are relevant kinds of things that Stan has brought up that would drive us to make more pragmatic decisions as opposed to political decisions about the recommendations, and to struggle with that as our foundation, maybe we can gain more credibility as a committee if we take that approach, as opposed to, you know, reacting politically to this and voting on some kind of a recommendation in our next meeting. Not that we can't make a recommendation at the next meeting, but to try and gather some of this information, and I would have to acquiesce to stand in terms of maybe some of the fundamentals that would be very, very important for us to be able to help analyze the true impact of our situation. You know, our world today is pretty small. You know, we talk about the citizen legislature issue, and golly, in the 1800s, it was pretty hard to get back and forth. You know, and today we're back and forth way out in the pucker brush where I live, you know, in a day. It's only a 4-hour drive. You know, but we got internet, and we got all kinds of things that we're connected. You know, we're back and forth with letters and all kinds of stuff. We are an instant society today in the things that we deal with. And so how can we step up the plane of our responsibility and deal with some more of the factual materials that really impact the par excellence that we want to see in our state government.
Mr. Chairman, if I may?
Yeah, Mr. Drew.
You can't. And I say that
that's
bluntly.
That's not a...
No, I know, I understand.
It's not an effective word,
John.
Yeah.
But, again, my point was... The system is horribly awkward, yes. You have time constraints within the framework of this committee's...
legal charter.
Legal charter, and so that's one side. And now I'm going to say, here's where the can't comes in. To assess the market position and assess what might be a series of recommendations relative to that market position and... direction. You don't have the time for it. You simply do not have the time for it. Hence my saying, you will go through the normal mechanics and we will come up with a set of recommendations for which the legislature will then massage however they do that. But aside from that, and that's what I was encouraging the rest of the group to consider, that there's a recommendation that goes with it that says you're going to have to do something long term. Because the kind of things that John's talking about are the issues of market, are the issues of internal pressures that will come to bear in rather ugly ways longer term. We're just starting to see it. And you can talk about the magnificence of the public life, but there are professionals out there, and they have other people, there are other references, etc. Those will have to be considered. So, again... You don't have time to look at the kind of... You can get some ideas of it. I want to tell you, a compression analysis is a detailed item. and particularly when it goes off into an analysis of candidate lists and how that has impacted whether or not you get to your first or second choice. The data probably doesn't even exist in a state setting. So it says, this committee will probably come to its conclusion as quickly as possible, given the constraints of the legislature and the finance discussion that have to occur there. But we should also then consider a strong recommendation to legislature that they, example, separate the political from the professional as it relates to the market, those kinds of things. Tell the legislature that this is not going to work long term. This is our collective opinion. If it is, I mean, it's mine right now. But I've seen it for the first time 2 years ago, and it's just gotten worse. Now, as market accelerates, that will get more so. So, again, that's where it is. John, my apologies, but we don't have time to do that within the confines of, because I know what's involved. You don't have time to do it.
Mr. Chair.
Just to add on to that, I think we basically have two structural problems we're facing here. First of all, as I understand the original intent of this compensation council, and the first one I was on, I heard Senator Spear, who I think was here at the very first compensation council, talk about the promise, which was to take this out of politics, to have regular increases for state employees, some type of considered deliberative process to do that. And if you look at what's happened, these blank spaces suggest to me it just isn't working. And if you were to take this and put it back into the early 90s and the 80s, you'd see the same type of things. These gaps are just killer. So we have a process that's not working very well. We've, I think, seen some recent progress in terms of the judges, some regular increases, so we don't have to do these big percentage, big whopper. People are falling behind. And then the second issue is we've had discussion, I think, at the last Compensation Council and now here again this year about some of the information that would guide a more educated discussion and maybe bringing better information forward to the legislature to consider what are the recommendations based on what that maybe could kickstart this process and give it a little more credibility. So as we contemplate the type of report we're going to put together for this year, I would hope that one element that we would include is some type of recommendation to the legislature that as this compensation council, however convened and whoever the appointees are 2 years from now, this is the type of information we think should be assembled so that this isn't a welcome to the compensation council, you've got 17 minutes and you need to make a recommendation, and oh, by the way, you go out of business in about 14 minutes. And you know, that's what we've been dealing with these last couple cycles. And I think the last two times we've talked about getting a better process. So I hope we will consider those type of recommendations as part of the report so that next time, you know, staff does a great job of telling us where we've been, but we're a little lacking on where we ought to go. That's not just incremental from the last recommendation that was that nothing happened. A couple other comments just very briefly. As we contemplate proposals being put in, I think the senator made an excellent remarks here about, to me, this is a matter of fairness and respect for state employees and our elected officials. You know, I've had the privilege of knowing many constitutional officers and judges and legislators over the years, and these are hardworking, good people who provide tremendous public service to our state. And the notion that we can go big blocks of time without even something like a cost of living increase, to me, is just unacceptable, and I think we need to, again, address that and hope that something will happen. I certainly respect the governor's position about his salary, but I think it's incumbent upon us as members of this commission to not look at individual occupants of any of these offices, but rather look at these positions and the public trust we put in these positions and the good work that these men and women have done for us and adjust that appropriately. And as I say, if you look at what's happened, 1999 for legislators, 1998 for the governor, that's just a situation that I think is unacceptable. And my head hurts when I start thinking about the reality of what's happened. The inability of us to be more effective in getting our recommendations adopted has led to all sorts of bizarre circumstances. I mean, local governments coming to the legislature saying, you're tied to the governor. We can't get the people we need to run these billion-dollar, multi-hundreds of million-dollar public institutions. And so there's a need to lift the cap so that we exempt out and around. And it's just all twisted and contorted. And we really need, I think, something better than an every two-year incremental, what did we do last time? Let's try the same thing or maybe dress it a little bit different. And we need to make recommendations about what should come. So if somebody's contemplating a proposal that would say, let's let's appreciate the progress we made with the judges, continue that, and let's do something for the constitutional officers, and let's do something for the legislators that will find support here for that type of proposal. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I might add that I have not been here since the inception of this council, but I look around this table and I look at the amount of talent and care that is and time and energy that's being dedicated to work at this council. And I like to think that in whatever recommendations we make, I hope we also take a look at fundamentally how the work of this council will be received by the legislature. Because if the work of this council is susceptible to the whims of, you know, whatever the legislature feels they want to do, then we're basically irrelevant. And, you know, as a member of this council, I feel like I like my time here to have some meaning. And whatever recommendations we make, for that to be somehow relevant and have an impact. And just in the couple hours I've been here and listening to the discussion and listening to council's iteration of the different recommendations that never really went anywhere, leads me to wonder, you know, where is the bite to what we're putting forth? If we're going to be asked as a council to do serious contemplation and bring back in an apolitical kind of way recommendations, then where is the connection, or where is the hook that our recommendation would be given weight? Otherwise, any work that we put into this council, whether short-term or long-term, becomes irrelevant to the political process, depending on the political and fiscal whims of whichever cycle that we end up in. And so, you know, I think that part of the recommendation we should go back with is maybe legislative change in terms of what the function of this council is. I don't know, but I think we should think about that, because then we'll make ourselves irrelevant, and the recommendations we make irrelevant when people choose, the legislature just chooses to ignore the recommendations.
Any other thoughts?
That bothers me, your comment, Senator, in that, golly, the legislators, as you are a member, are elected to be responsible.
Right.
And we were designated to feed information. You know, they have, you know, if we feel that we're irrelevant, then maybe we need to look at some of the foundation of our issue, as opposed to trying to come back with the idea that, hey, we're an important element here. We aren't. We have not been elected. We've been asked to serve in this capacity. That's cool. It's nice. You know, in that sense. But our legislators have been elected to then take the onus of responsibility of the people of the state of Minnesota and what they do with our recommendations.
And Mr. Chair, I respect that tremendously. And that's why I've made the comment that I have, which is that I see every day, and I value the work of entities like this. And increasingly, we've needed to given the complexity of the work that we do through the legislative process, we continually establish committees and commissions and task forces to do an in-depth look at an infrastructural or structural or programmatic, or do an in-depth study and then come back with very concrete and specific recommendations. And we hope then that legislature, whatever body, receives that information, will translate that into law, and that would have a broad impact in the state. On this issue, it is inherently political. And if sitting around here and having this discussion, we know that it is inherently political. When we ask legislators to vote for their own salary increases, on the one hand, we want them to be true to who they are and to be able to go to the public and say, I voted for my salary increases and I'm willing to take the hit for that. But for that very reason is the reason why the legislature has been held hostage to that discussion and have not been able to move in making that decision. And I think that it is no secret that the governor is sending us the message. He, too, is a political actor and political animal. And so that's why when we started this discussion, I started out by saying that there's a larger issue here. Before we can even get to the point of having a governor stepping forward to say, yes, I would like to take the salary increase. Before we even get to the point of judges being able to say, yes, I would like to have a salary increase. Before legislators like myself would be able or willing to step forward and say, yes, my family and I would like a salary increase. People will be put in a conflicted position to come forward and be willing to vote on something like that or make that kind of statement because inherently we're political animals subject to the judgment of the public. And at this juncture in our political reality, the public out there has the opinion that we are not valued, we are not doing our job, and we are not worthy. We are not worthy of engaging in this discussion. And so when I say that this group, in order for us to have some bite, should come back with some recommendations to look at the long-term impact. We should come back with some recommendation to say that at some point, whether in legislation or whatever, that a group such as this group, maybe not this group, but a group such as this group should be able to make those kind of recommendations in an apolitical setting, and that those decisions ought to have some weight that should bind the legislature or the public figures in some way, if that's really where we want to go. And what I hear is that there's good intention in this group to try to do that kind of work. But we have some real constraints in terms of time constraint, in terms of, you know, what we're really able to do, because we are subject to the rhythm of the legislative session. And so my recommendation is just that, understanding that reality, if we're going to make some recommendations back, then let's not fall into the same pattern that this council has been engaging in since the inception of this council. If we want to make some real changes, then we should maybe in our recommendations back say, and oh, by the way, you know, if you want this legislative council to do the real work and fulfill the real intentions of what you want to do, then what we say have to have some bind in how the legislature behaves.
Senator Lapp.
Mr. Chairman, in some ways the politics and the legislature hold ourselves hostage, but in a very real sense, I think the governor's holding the legislature hostage. The governor's holding hostage all of the employees for whom he's recommending no salary increase whatsoever, because that's the political angle on this. Every one of us who might consider, in the legislature anyway, who might consider voting for a salary increase is going to be blasted by the governor, either individually or collectively, if we do that. And it's clearly a political judgment by the governor, because he apparently didn't even consider the issues relating to cost of living increases for all of these employees of state government when deciding his recommendation. I think I'd like to ask staff before the next meeting to provide each of us with information regarding the governor's total compensation package, the value of the housing the governor receives, the value of the transportation, the auto the governor receives, and gas that the governor gets paid for, and heat and electricity that the governor gets paid for in his housing, and whether there has been any increase in any of that portion of the governor's compensation package since this governor took office. And perhaps we ought to consider, if we're going to be using the governor's compensation as a benchmark, that we not look just at salary, but the governor's total compensation package, if we're going to tie percentages to that. It is political. I think we have to recognize that. And it would be nice if we could step aside from that and try to make some real objective professional judgments about what's appropriate in terms of compensation recommendations to the legislature. And if the professional recommendation judgment is no salary increase is warranted, then, and if that's based upon, you know, statistical background and the kind of studies that Mr. Dirt is talking about and those kind of things, then you'll find then the analysis will speak for itself and it will carry the weight and the merit that it deserves. But if the conclusion is different, there needs to be some, then I think that also needs to be reflected, and it will carry whatever weight it also merits in that regard.
Mr. Stabler.
Senator, yes, thank you. Certainly that's relevant. One of the things I had in my notes in this is that we should really take a look at that in a full package sense from each of the senators, each of the House members, all of the individuals that we are responsible for. What are their health care costs on an annual basis? Their group life, their group dental. What are their pension costs? And how are those things impacted into the total? I would like to see, from my perspective, what is a percentage total cost to compensation? So if the salary is $31,000, then what is the total compensation as a percentage of that that is yours as a serving senator, same as the governor, and the various constitutional officers also? I think that has meaning and relevance. I do a lot of that type of work, or have done a lot of that type of work, in the private sector, where you look at the total compensation of the individual, not only just the salary. And I think that's relevant to what we're trying to do here.
Mrs. Swain.
Mr. Chair, well, it's very difficult, although this whole council concept was intended to try and diminish the impact of politics on the process, and it's difficult to not be conscious of it. Let me again just read the few words from Mr. Botern. Do I pronounce that correct? Botern or Botern? Botern, sorry. What must the council consider in making its recommendations? What must the council? The council is instructed by statute to consider the amount of compensation paid in government service in the private sector to persons with similar qualifications, the amount needed to attract and retain experienced and competent persons, and the ability of the state to pay the recommended levels. In making recommendations for legislators, the council is also required to consider the average length of legislative sessions, the amount of work required of legislators during the interim, and the members' opportunities to earn income from other sources without neglecting their legislative duties. It's difficult to confine ourselves to that without the realities of politics, but this is what it says we must do.
That's a great review. Is there other input tonight?
Mr. Chairman,
if I may.
Yeah.
It's difficult, as you pointed out, to offer a perspective within the framework of the political atmosphere. You see holes all over it. That's obviously the politics. But I'll offer one more. Because within that paragraph you read, I would say, without an external analysis of what are the comparative points, without benchmarks, you have no reference at all. It becomes opinion. That makes it almost impossible. And I'm somewhat biased, but you look at it and you say, well, we're going to have, just in the strength of that paragraph, which harkens back to what I was talking about earlier, the system is something we should be commenting about.
The answer to that, if you please, would be that this council would be convened last September.
At least.
Is there other input tonight? If not, please forward your suggestions to Mr. Hubinger, and we'll review them and see if we can arrive at consensus. And I'll be in touch with you. And as Ms. Keene said, our next meeting is March 27 at 4 p.m. And will it be in this room or another?
I'll have to check availability.
You'll let us know?
Yes, I will email everyone.
Don't forget so you know your...
Mr. Chair, can I also ask members to please leave your folders and your nameplates so we can put information in there for the next meeting? You're free to take all the material, and if you have expense reimbursement sheets, please leave those with us so I can get the chair to sign them. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and with that, is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Thank you.